Well, good morning. It's been a good day thus far. We're in a sermon series entitled Charting a Good Course. And taking the analogy here of a sailing ship that years ago would sail from continent to continent across the ocean. And so that's the analogy that we're using. And of course, a sailing ship would leave port initially. When they get out into the open ocean, they would have to set their sails to, you know, take into consideration the direction of the wind and the currents that they were sailing in. They would set their course. Along the way, they would encounter storms. They might encounter all kinds of obstacles. Maybe sometimes they would be calm. There would be no wind for a while, and they would just sit there until the winds came up again, and they would make their necessary adjustments so that they could arrive safely at their destination. And it's such a perfect analogy of what life is, with the storms that we encounter, the difficulties, and we're going to look at some of that today. You know, in life we sail different courses. There's the course of family, which is what we're going to look at today. There's the course of our faith. There's the course of friendships that we need to be able to chart our direction through. We're going to look at finances. There's the course of our field of work, our field of endeavor, whatever that might be. And so following a course is all about continuing to move in a certain direction. You know, you take, for example, the course of finances. We all have to deal with finances in life. And the Bible has very clear, straightforward instruction about how to deal with finances. And it's to move us in a certain direction. Because at the end of our life, we want to be in, you know, the goal would be to be able to end our life financially, not independently wealthy, perhaps, that might be nice, but to be able to be comfortable, to not have any financial burdens or responsibilities and debts over us. We don't want to end off our life financially broke and bankrupt. And so, you know, we move in that direction. And if you start out in that direction spending more than you are making, you know that kind of, if you continue with that, you're not going to get there. And so, in all of these aspects of life, we want to chart a good course. And today, we just want to talk about the course of family. And the first thing, of course, we do is, when we are charting this course, is we leave port. And we leave port in our sailing ship, and, you know, we've got this idea in mind of what we want, you know, to have as our experience of family. And every one of us has that in mind when we leave port. And the first thing that is necessary is to choose a good mate, because this is the person that you are going to be establishing your family with. Now, here in Western society, you get to choose who your mate is. And, you know, there's a lot of places around the world where you don't get that privilege. You get it arranged, or you know, walk in the house one day and there she is sitting there, and that's who you're going to be marrying. But this choosing of a mate is an important process. It takes thought, it takes discernment and prayer. And the goal is for you to be able to find a good wife or a good husband. You know, Proverbs 18:22 says that. It says, "He who finds a wife finds what is good and receives favor from the Lord." Now, if you find a wife, and this obviously these things are generally written from the male perspective. So, you know, men, if you find a wife, you find what is good. Women, if you find a husband, you know, you found something that is good. Of course, it's only good if you've chosen a good wife. If you haven't chosen a good wife, or if you haven't chosen a good husband, it's not going to be very good for you. And we can see that borne out in life all over the place in many different areas, in many, many different ways. So the question is, how do you find a good wife? And for some of you, say, well, I've already done that, you know, but so, you know, this point, maybe not, you might not think it applies to you, but obviously if you're still looking out there, you're looking for somebody. And it's important for us to know and be reminded of these things and just to be affirmed even in our own experiences. How do you find a good wife? You know, I remember when I was a young person and I was entering the whole dating scene, and I heard said, or I read it somewhere, never choose a date who wouldn't be a good mate. You know, it's so simple, but it's true. Isn't that true? I mean, you don't choose a date who wouldn't make a good mate. And yet I see people, you know, young people doing that all the time. Oh, yeah, no, I'm not going to marry. I would never marry that person, you know. But, we want to go out, maybe just, you know, enjoy or have a good time together or whatever. I think, why? It's kind of like, you know, if I need to buy a vehicle, I've got a family, got a wife and a couple kids, and I need to buy a vehicle, so it's got to be a good-sized vehicle. And I go to the car lot, and I tell the salesman, you know, what it is I'm looking for, and he says, well, he says, we got this really neat little Porsche Boxster over here. Just seat a couple of you, but it's a fun, yeah, but... you know, that's not really going to suit me. No. You see, this is a really cool car. Look at the lines. They're so nice. You're going to have fun in this car. But it's not what's going to suit my needs. Well, okay, we got this. Here's a really cool Harley Davidson that just came in. Now, that I might go for. Family can walk. You know, you kind of know what kind of a wife or husband you want to have someday. So why would you choose somebody that doesn't fit that description of an individual? And so, you know, for believers, for Christians, for people who are following the Lord, there is one key characteristic right off the top that should govern your choices, and that is, number one, they've got to be a Christian. They have to be somebody that shares your faith, that will be able to encourage and support you in your faith, which is the most important thing in your life. And so, number one, you want to look for a Christian. Number two, you know, and these are kind of my standards, okay? A was a Christian girl. B was, she had to be good looking. And, you know, I wanted to be at least good looking for me, you know? And I had to be attracted to this person. I wanted this to be somebody that I enjoyed going out with. And, a little bit of a trophy. You know, have this trophy on my arm. The attractiveness factor is there. If you're not attracted to the person, man, I feel sorry for you. You know, you're always fighting against that. And then thirdly, there's got to be compatibility. You know, do you just get along? And when you think of those things, number one, to be a Christian, I mean, that's what church life provides for you. That's what church youth rallies provide for you. You know, going to places and being with people that will put you into contact with other prospective Christians, with people that are suitable. Yesterday after the Bombers game, it was, of course, the reason we got the tickets cheaply was because it was sponsored by Athletes in Action. And after the game, in the tent out there, they had a couple of the Bombers players came out, and I couldn't stay for the whole thing. I just stayed. I heard Matthias Goosen, I think is his name, the center. And he was talking about his experiences of playing football in Simon Fraser University. And he said, you know, the locker room and the gridiron is not really a Christian place. There's a lot of, you know, stuff that goes on that is non-Christian in the football environment. And so he had another Christian friend on the team, and they agreed together, you know, we need to go places where we're going to be able to connect with Christian girls. And so they started going to Campus Crusade and the Athletes in Action group in SFU, and that's where he found his wife. You know, I contrast that with somebody that I talked to a number of years ago, and they said, well, you know what, if God... you know, wants me to find a Christian husband, he'll send him along. In the meantime, she was going to all kinds of places where she's not going to run into Christians. You know, whether it was the bars or the certain restaurants or clubs or parties or events, those aren't Christian environments. You're not going to meet a good mate there, somebody who follows the Lord, who shares your faith. And for her to say, well, if God wants me to find a good Christian man, he'll send him into my life. But you got to do something along the way as well. It's kind of like a farmer who says, well, if the Lord wants me to have a good harvest, he'll raise the wheat. Meanwhile, I'm not going to plant it. I'm not going to plow it. I'm not going to cultivate it. If he wants me to have it, he'll put it there. No, he won't, because there's something that you need to do there as well. Find a Christian. The attractiveness, I'll leave it up to your own standards. But the compatibility issue, this third thing, do you get along? You know, that's what courtship is all about, finding somebody that you can get along with and enjoy their company. And, you know, these are things that, you know, there's a lot of just common sense in here as well. But the first thing you want to do is make sure that you choose a good mate. When you've found that person who's going to be your mate for life, then let the two become one. You know, we read in the scriptures that God created man, that's man generic, in his image. He created mankind, male and female. And he brought together that first man and that first woman, and he joined them together. And then we have this wonderful statement in Genesis chapter 2, where the man said, when he looked at Eve and God brought her, presented her to him, he said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This is someone like me. And she's not covered with fur or feathers like the cheetah or the ostrich, you know. She doesn't have hoofed feet like a horse. You know, she's someone like me. Bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and will be united to his wife, and they will become, and this is the key statement, they will become one flesh. This is the first statement of marriage. And you know, for some reason today, in the world's wisdom, the wisdom of the world is totally contrary to God's wisdom. Understand that. And as the world, as our leaders and our politicians and our thinkers and our social scientists and all the rest, as they have become more and more wise, and I use that term advisedly, but as they have become more and more wise, they have gotten further and further away from God's standard. And so that today, there's this foolish and ridiculous notion that anybody can be your partner, and, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's a member of the opposite sex or not. Like, what kind of wisdom is this? It's not God's wisdom. The world, Paul says, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And today it's necessary to state the obvious, that you need a man and you need a woman to form one flesh. Can't be done with two men, and it can't be done with two women. And the result of that one flesh is an offspring of one flesh, a child. Basic biology that seems to have escaped the minds of the so-called wise of this world. This one flesh union is a sacred concept through all of Scripture. And that's why I had Ben read this passage here in Proverbs chapter 6 that talks about the dangers of lusting after another woman, of pursuing someone who is not part of that one flesh union that you have established with your mate. The dangers are there listed, not just in chapter 6, you go into chapter 7 as well. There's a whole story in chapter 7, whole story of a young man that says, at the window of my house I looked out through the lattice and I saw among the simple, I noticed a young man, a youth who lacked judgment, going down the street near her corner, walking along in the direction of her house, at twilight as the day was fading, as the dark of night set in. And then he meets a woman, and he has an illicit relationship with her, and he's persuaded by her. And then it says that in the end, he says he's like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into a noose, till an arrow pierces his liver, like a bird darting into a snare, little knowing that it will cost him his life. And you see, this notion that you can just kind of do whatever you want sexually, that's the wisdom of the world. God's standard is sanctity of a union of one flesh between a man and a woman committed to each other who will follow his way in their life. There are many people who are drawn in. Many Christians fall as well. And you know, the good news is that even after you have fallen, even after you have slipped up, there is a road back. Jesus is all about redeeming. He's all about restoring. He's all about bringing people back into his fold. But it doesn't mean that we should just take these things lightly. We don't sin that grace may abound. Thank God that there is a road of redemption and restoration. But even that takes a lot of work. I've seen cases with couples that have worked through cases of infidelity, situations of infidelity. It takes a lot of work. It takes grace on the part of the one. It takes a lot of humility on the part of the other. It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of commitment to be able to do it. But by God's grace, it can be done. Well, once you've found your mate and once you've left port, you set your sails. And I've got this little statement, add to your quiver. What's that all about? You know, maybe some of you guys who go bow hunting, you know what a quiver is all about. But I love this verse in Psalm 127. It says, sons are a heritage from the Lord. Children are a reward from him. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are sons born in one's youth and daughters. Remember I said the Bible's written from a male perspective. I love this. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. A quiver full of arrows. A household full of children is like a quiver full of arrows. Well, we all know that houses don't seem to be full of children anymore. You know, maybe two, three, maybe not even that. The concept of a full quiver has gotten a lot smaller. But the idea here that your quiver is full of children, they will not be put to shame when they contend with their enemies in the gates. Another cultural analogy there. But you know, every couple looks forward to having children, to be able to raise a family. That's such a fundamental, foundational perspective on life. When you find that mate, you want to be able to join together, to be able to raise a family, to be able to have children. You have the dream of togetherness, and you have this vision of what it's going to be like as we sit around the table and all of our children sitting there nicely dressed and well-behaved and speaking kindly and graciously to one another, and just, you know, wonderful soft music playing in the background and just this wonderful, you know, eating off of elegant dishes and wonderful meals. It's just going to be so wonderful. And then we find out that it's not. There's spilled milk, and there's angry words, and there's sitting or slouching at the table, and all this. But the togetherness that we develop, even in those times, there's togetherness that develops around that in that family setting. Whether it's special times of the year, Thanksgiving and Christmas, or whether it's family vacation, you know, going on that trip, you had all that car trouble and all those things. Whether it's just the joy of seeing your children grow up and being able to instruct them and teach them. I remember thinking how great it's going to be to teach my sons how to play ball. And I can still remember so clearly that those first experiences with the baseball glove and teach them how to catch it and the look of delight on their face when finally he looked into the glove. I had him stand off about 10 feet and he held the glove out. I kind of lobbed the ball. And after about the 20th time, it landed in his glove. And once it landed in his glove, the look of delight on his face, oh man, he was so happy. And, you know, it's fun. It's fun. It really is. To be able to see your children grow, to be able to teach them, to be able to watch their development. There's setbacks when it comes to raising children as well. We know that. There's setbacks when it comes to trying to add to your quiver, to be able to build up your stable, as it were. Some people have the setback of infertility. They can't have kids. It's a biological problem. They've gone to see the doctors. They've gone to the clinics. It just doesn't work. And God bless them. They oftentimes turn to adopt and to bring into their family someone from outside, a child or a baby from outside who otherwise would never have the opportunity of experiencing the love and connection and warmth of a family. Other couples suffer the setback of miscarriages. and all of the expectation of months of waiting, weeks and months of waiting and looking forward to the date of the birth, all of a sudden is cut short and never happens. And there's a tremendous sense of loss and even inadequacy that can come into those situations. Other couples have their children and then at a later time in life lose them. And this has got to be the greatest and worst kind of loss and setback when it comes to children that there can be. And it's at those times of setbacks and difficulties that a couple, a husband and wife, console and encourage each other. And not only that, but they draw on God's grace for their lives and encouragement from God's word and from other friends and family around them. Really, you know, when we look upon those situations, there's nothing we can really do but support those people and encourage them any way we can with words and with embraces to let them know that even though we can't do anything to change the situation, at least we can encourage them and let them know that we love them. With these little lives that we're given, we guide their lives. You know, this is all basic stuff today. This is just meat and potatoes today, okay? It's just basic information from God's word, but it's important that we know these things and that we have these kinds of this kind of knowledge to be able to guide the young lives that God has given to us. There's a great responsibility. This is the great responsibility of parenthood, to be able to provide for these children, these little lives. And we just had a new granddaughter born a couple weeks ago, and again, I'm just so amazed as I look at that little body. And I always think of this short little body all scrunched up in the blankets, all swaddled up. And I think inside that little body, there's a functioning heart, and there's lungs, and there's a liver, and stomach, and intestines, and there's a brain, and there's, you know, everything is in there. It's just astounding. And that it all came that way, it all developed that way in 9 months from nothing. It's just an amazing thing that God has granted to us. And so we love that little one. We provide for them. We teach them. We nurture them. We encourage them through disappointments in life. And then finally, we kick them out of the nest. Right? Because they got to fly in their own sometime too. And all that loving and nurturing, encouraging and providing and so forth is so that the time comes when they are able to stand on that nest and take their leap and away they fly. Sometimes they just a short time and then they got to come back to the nest, you know, get them to catch their breath and then we give them a little bit more direction and off they go again. But that's how it works. And it's been well said that the two things we give our children is roots, and what's the other one? Wings. That's right. Roots and wings. You can get those up at Boston Pizza every Wednesday night for. Proverbs 4:3-4, kind of talks about that. Solomon says, "When I was a boy in my father's house, still tender, and an only child of my mother, he taught me and said, 'Lay hold of my words with all your heart, keep my commands.'" And you will live. That's what parents do. Parents teach their kids, listen, this, because a child comes into the world, they don't know what's going on. I mean, you know, you don't know as a child, as a four-year-old child, you don't know to look both ways in the street. You don't know anything about cars coming down the street going to hit you and hurt you. That's why they have to be taught and taught over and over again. And so all of this teaching happens, and we tell our children, we give our children important instruction, and the way that we tell them is with sincerity and with conviction. Lay hold of my words with all your heart. Keep these commands and you will live, because we want them to live. We want them to succeed. We want them to prosper. We're not going to give them advice that's going to lead them astray. And sometimes, as children, you know, we didn't understand it that way. We thought that it was just our parents trying to cramp our style or hold us back, but that's not why they're giving those commands. That's not why parents give that kind of instruction. It's so that their children can live and prosper and succeed. Well, there's more we could say there. We need to move on. There's storms that come in life. As that ship sails across the ocean, there's always storms. You know, there's storms in the husband-wife relationship that arise. There's storms in the parent-child relationship that arise. And sometimes the storms are severe, sometimes they're little squalls. But, you know, as I thought about this, I thought, okay, just a couple of things. We can't go into all the issues of communication and conflict resolution here this morning, but as a principle, if you're going to disagree on things between as husband and wife, okay, this is the first thing we'll look at. Between husband and wife, there's going to be storms that pop up. Disagree agreeably. You know, when the disagreements arise, when the differences of opinion arise, how do you deal with it in your marriage? Because the way you deal with it is setting the example for your children. The stronger one, the one who is stronger, maybe even physically stronger, in which case it would be the man, who he could just enforce his way. This is the way it's going to be, and this is the way we're going to do it, and you know, I'm the one. You could enforce compliance, in which case it's just the power of the strongest one, so he learns the law of the jungle in that case. The strong survive. I guess a second way of disagreeing would be just to argue and fight until one of you gets your way, until somebody finally gives in. Okay, fine, we'll do it. That'd be another way of doing it. Proverbs has some instruction for us. It says, reckless words pierce like a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. You need to bring a little wisdom into your disagreements, don't we? We need to think about what we're saying. We need to consider what the effects are going to be. I think this is the wiser way, is to discuss the matter carefully and thoughtfully. You know, when arguments arise, then our emotions get worked up as well. And emotions are just the expression of our feelings. We feel a certain way and boom, there's a certain emotion that goes along with that. And it's important to realize that those feelings and those emotions, those are legitimate. Okay, if somebody says something to you and you feel a certain way about that, then that feeling, it's real. But it's how we deal with it that is important. How you talk about those feelings. Yeah, guys, talk about your feelings, okay? You know, instead of saying, you do this and you do that, you know, we need to be willing to say, you know, I don't really feel that that's not something I want to do. Or I don't feel like that's the right thing. You know, these are better ways of talking about these things, not using accusatory language like you did this and you never do this, or you always do this. I've said that a few times. You always do, always? Always? Not getting defensive about things. One more verse from Proverbs says this: a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. And to learn how to even disagree in a gentle way, in a way that is not going to stir up anger. Remember, anger is only one letter away from danger. Parents, oftentimes, they have to deal with disobedience and even rebellion amongst their children, isn't it? That's something that often comes up. Raising children is a case of continually instructing, correcting, warning, and punishing. And you know, this Proverbs talks about that as well, many times. Proverbs 13:24 says, he who spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is careful to discipline him. You know, unfortunately, people have taken this verse to mean, oh, that means I got to use a rod on my son and really beat him. You know, it's been used as justification for that. We're talking about the rod of discipline there. It could be a figurative rod. Now, there was a day, and probably a lot of you grew up in that day, when there was a rod or there was a switch that was used on you. Can't do that anymore. Don't do that anymore. And that's a good thing. But nonetheless, there is discipline that needs to be brought to bear when raising our children. And, you know, knowing when to use discipline, knowing when to punish. Again, kinds of discussion could be had on that. There's books on child rearing. Thank God that there are many good Christian books and resources today that parents have to draw on to be able to understand. But standing up to rebellion, I think, is important. That when if a child makes a mistake, you don't punish them for that. If a child, you know, forgets something, you don't punish them for that. But when a child willfully disobeys and willfully goes against your will and your desire and is causing upheaval and discord in the home, that's where there needs to be something done and even punishment as the need arises. Finally, as we go through all this and we deal with the difficulties and the storms of life, we want to be able to arrive safely. And you know, as a family, among all the things that happen, we want to strive for unity. The Bible talks a lot about unity. Paul, in one place, makes the statement, he says, make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit, talking about the church there. But within the family, the bonds of unity are developed when children are small, with those dinners and those trips I talked about earlier. And, you know, here's a verse from Proverbs that says, better a meal of vegetables where there is love than a fattened calf with hatred. Better to have just a simple meal of vegetables if there's love and harmony in the home. That's what you strive for. Rather than the richest meal with all the fixings if there's hatred and discord going on. That's not a pleasant place to be. Everything should be in an atmosphere of love, connection with each other. You know, there are going to be differences of opinion, especially when the children do leave the house and make their own life. You know, there are going to be times that, and we know this from experience, I know this from experience, where life decisions are made and lifestyles are lived that I don't agree with. But you know what? In all of that, my wife and I have said we want to make sure that we maintain the unity of our family as much as we possibly can. The only way that we can have a relationship is if there is unity. The only way that we can influence behavior is if there's a relationship. And it's better to strive for that unity as much as possible with all the family members together. And then finally, to be able to leave a legacy. In Proverbs 13:22, it says this, a good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. I showed my dad that verse once. Dad, a good man leaves an inheritance. But a sinner's wealth is stored up for the righteous. That inheritance can be material, but it can also be spiritual. You know, each inheritance is made up of just steady, regular deposits over the long term. If you're leaving a material inheritance, you're going to leave money in an account and investments that grow so that you can leave an inheritance. Every parent wants to leave an inheritance of some kind to their children. But there's also the spiritual inheritance that needs to be left as well. The continual deposit of prayers, of encouraging words, of acts of kindness and encouragement that go on through the life of our children as we sail this course and seek to arrive safely at that port with our family intact. You know, someday, Lily, I'll ask you to come up here and the team to sing our closing song. Someday, we're going to all stand before God, and God is going to say to us as parents and to you as children, he's going to say, what did you do with that family that I gave you? Parents, what did you do with those children that I gave you? Husband, what did you do with that wife that I gave you? Were you building her up? Were you encouraging her? Were you always arguing with her and cutting her down and criticizing her? Wife, what did you do with that husband that I gave you? Were you thanking me for him? Were you honoring him? Were you helping him in his work? You know, what did you do with each other? We're going to give an account for that someday. And we want to know that we have been partners together on this ship called family, sailing from port to our destination, leaving a legacy, striving for unity, so that we can honor God in our lives. Let's close with our last song. Lily, please lead us. Okay, thanks.